Welcome to the Rise Network podcast show, a podcast dedicated to help you reach your dream lifestyle through investing in real estate. We're going to be sitting down with new, intermediate, and experienced investors to talk all about real estate and how it has changed their lives. If you're looking to scale your portfolio or even just get into real estate investing, you're in the right place. Make sure to tune in.
Hello, hello. Good morning, everyone. Good night, good evening, good whatever. Bonjour, everyone. You're listening to the Rise Real Estate Investing Podcast. I'm here with my host, Mayu. Mayu, what is up, man?
It always ends up on me first, eh? Last week, not too bad. Real estate-wise, we've been pretty quiet. No real acquisitions. Just been watching the market a little bit. We're trying to stabilize a lot of our projects that are on the go. So finalize we've got a lot of student rentals that we locked up during COVID. So now it's about making sure we can have those rented out for Jan 1st before we miss that window of opportunity, right? And obviously rents are down now. So that's expected when we bought these properties and they were all like long-term acquisitions, right? So in the long term, the rents will catch up and they'll be cash flow beasts. What's going on with you, man? What would you say is the highlight of your last week? What happened at 1:30 in the morning?
So I came back from a mastermind event with, you guys know Waylon was on this podcast, and Michael from I think Canada Home Buyers, I think that's his business name. I hope I'm saying it right. Sorry, Michael, if you're listening to it, and I'm not, but he's a wholesaler down here in Ontario, one of the biggest ones actually, and we were just masterminding and chatting. Got home late, but I just felt motivated. I was like, I need to get some off-market deals, and got a lead and contacted them out 1 a.m. in the middle of the night through a text message, and they responded. And I put an offer out there with a condition. I don't know if they're going to take it, but it has, even if they do, it has like a week conditional period. So I'm going to do my due diligence during that period and we'll see what comes out of it. I'm actually not feeling too confident about them accepting it, but it's what works for me. And that's probably the max I'm going to go at. And I just know for the risk I'm taking, this is the max I want to put in. Other than that, we have a project. One of them is going to be wrapping up next week, a student rental. The one with all of the permits issues that if you guys have been following us along our journey, either on Instagram or on the podcast, that student rental project with all the city coming in and out, we're about to wrap that up. So that's going to be exciting. And we're already embarking on another student rental, like a duplex. So that renovation is going well. And we're about to do one more duplex and just kind of do cosmetic renovations on that duplex and we're good to go. But we have a lot of student rentals on the go. How are you feeling about that?
It's big risk, big reward, man. They're going to be cash flow monsters, right? Like when we talk about great cash flow numbers, and ultimately we're doing this for cash flow, like a single family house, 500 is great. But when you can get one slash single family house that can be a student rental and can cash flow you 1,000 to 1,500, you really just need a couple of those, right? So I really like the student rental market. I've been a student before. I like the tenant quality that comes with students. I know that that's probably unpopular opinion because the stereotype is students destroy your properties and the wear and tear is going to be higher, but I think it's justified by the fact that the odds of ending up at the LTB with the student tenant is a lot lower. And I think that's such a huge risk that is mitigated by doing student rentals. So I really like the
problem. There are so many ways to, whenever there's risk, there are ways to mitigate risk. So the wear and tear, I know investors who put cameras in the common areas and let the students know, look, guys, I'm putting on the common area. Here's a contract saying I will never, ever, ever review the camera unless there is some damage in the property and everyone's doing he say, she say. Because I don't want you all to pay this for this damage. I want the person accountable to pay for the damage. So here's a contract saying I'll never review it unless something like serious happens and there's no he say, she say. And he's still charging $650 to $700 a bedroom. Not anymore, right? But because of COVID, obviously. But how I see it right now is that it's a temporary demand shock. Nothing has changed. So Windsor has always had an issue with student rentals where there was not enough, right? Yeah. And the government has essentially completely stripped out all of the demand for student rentals temporarily because there's no people coming in the border. Universities are shut down. There's no new immigrants. So the entire demand is stripped. but it's we know in economics, temporary shock or shift in the demand curve. This is not a literal shift in demand curve. It is a cutoff of all demand. So all we have is supply. But then once demand comes back, we're right back where we were. We are at a housing crisis in Windsor for student rentals, which is why the prices were so expensive per bedroom. That fact does not change. It's just kind of hidden because of this short-term pain. Anyways, we're still going to be cash flow neutral, even cash flow positive in our student rentals, right? We're just going to turn it over in a year from now, though.
Yeah. And even at 400 to 500, which is what we're thinking about renting out the rooms at, the cash flow is decent. Like it's basically better than a single family house, right? The struggle is finding the tenant that will, take care of the property as well, per se. So I think student rental is a great game. It's what we've been doing for the last couple of months. We will know if we made the right decision come January, but ultimately, regardless of what happens in January, we're ready to weather the storm at least another 4 to 8 months without really too much of an issue. So
yeah, exactly. So problems or profits, guys, that's what we've been up to. That's how we've been justifying things for our portfolio right now, because we do have quite a bit of student rentals we're going to be leasing out very soon. So for the next couple of podcasts and our preambles, you'll probably hear about that. Anyways, let's jump straight into the podcast today. Today we have Troy Pierre. Troy Pierre is an investor I've known for a while at the very least. And when I was starting off, he was mentoring under Matt McKeever, huge Canadian real estate investor. And that's what got me thinking, like, I should work for someone for free to learn. So Troy's done a bunch of things in his real estate journey so far. He's worked completely for free while working a full-time job for one of the largest Canadian real estate YouTubers. He has done joint ventureships in the passive side. He has done a wholesaling on the active side. So, wow, what a 360. From active wholesaling to passive joint ventures. He's done his own properties as well, his own BRRRRs. So Troy has a lot of detail and information to give out, useful golden nuggets throughout the journey. And I actually like some of the wholesaling tips that he gave out. So you guys want to make sure to tune in, because you're always asking about off-market deals. Well, we touch on it a bit here. Hope you guys enjoy the podcast. Let's get straight into it. Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm here with Mayu and our very special guest, Troy Pierre. Am I pronouncing the last name right? Pierre?
Yeah. Persich, yeah. I just use P-I-R on Instagram, but Persich, yeah.
Oh, man. I feel like I've been fooled all of these years that I've known you.
I've been tricking you, man. I've got some tricks in the bag for you.
So Troy is a 27-year-old real estate investor, still relatively young. He's invested in different areas from Chatham, London, Sarnia. He's currently still working a full-time job and grinding it out. Correct me if I'm wrong, you're working at Imperial Oil, I believe. And on top of that, you've done so many different strategies in real estate, from BRRRRing, joint ventureship, so on and so forth. I'm sure we're going to dig down into it. I hope I did your introduction justice, Troy, but let's just dive straight into it. I want to get a little bit more background into how you got started with investing. So before you bought your first property, what were you up to and how did you get into the real estate scene?
Yeah, man. So realistically, it was super, super high level and super easy. Me and my friend, we both bought the Acre Real Estate Investing book from Don Campbell, Authentic Canadian Real Estate. We bought the book and we said, hey, let's each read this book over a month and we'll come back and kind of conjoin after. So we both read the book. We learned some really basic fundamentals, super high level stuff. And then we kind of just dove in. We messaged a realtor out in London. And then by the end of that week, we had an offer in on my first property. And it was a little nerve wracking for sure. But and this was prior to the market getting hot, where you could actually get market properties without multiples and going $40,000-$50,000 over. But anyways,
great times,
the good old days. But yeah, that's kind of how I first got started. You know, didn't have much education, really didn't know anything about real estate investing, just kind of dove in head first. And that's how I got started and got my first property.
Yeah. So Troy, so do you live in London? Why did you choose London? And
no, I didn't live in London. My friend lived in London. So really high level, it was supposed to be a joint venture, but it didn't end up working out that way. I ended up solely going in with it, but he lived in London. So I was going to provide the down payment and the mortgage, and he actually lived right around the corner. So he was going to manage the property, but yeah, that's why we decided London. And London's got a lot of great key factors for investing in it. You know, the appreciation's been Well, not at that time, but the appreciation since then's been great.
So how long ago was that? I'm guessing if there were, it wasn't bidding wars, it has to be at least 3 years ago, because as far as I'm concerned, the past 3 years, it's crazy.
It is. We bought it like the prime time. It was March of 2016. So I bought that before my own primary residence. So I kind of veered off the path from like what all my friends and everything were doing. I was still living in an apartment in downtown Sarnia, and I had some extra capital. So I decided real estate was the investment path of my choice.
Gotcha. And what was the game plan with that property? So was it a single family duplex? Is it like for cash flow or?
It was, man. It was just a single family. And like I said, I didn't know anything about real estate when I first bought this. So I assumed that everything, as like when you're purchasing something to rent out, everything is always turnkey, and everything that needs work is considered like a flip. So it was relatively turnkey. I think we spent like a day or two over there, like fixing a door and painting. And we bought it for $160,000. It was a four bed, one bathroom in the Carling District, which is just east of Adelaide. So we went against all the local stigmas and bought it anyway. We figured we'd be able to rent it out for like $1,100 a month plus utilities, and, you know, make $100 a month cash flow or whatever. And that would be fantastic. That's what we did. We ended up getting it. We were able to rent it out for $1,300 a month. And then obviously it's gone up since then. But yeah, it was just a standard single family buy and hold. It was a buy, appreciate, refinance.
You're claiming that now, eh? That's awesome.
Claiming that now. You heard it here first.
So where did you go after that then? So you got that single family house in London, and then what comes next?
So I took like a little bit of a hiatus. I bought my primary residence, which I was Airbnb-ing out for a while. It was just single rooms in the house. It was just me living here. It was a four bedroom, one bath house. So I Airbnb'd out two of the rooms. And then as my girlfriend moved in, we decided that, you know, it's not really as advantageous just anymore to have somebody kind of like walking around in the house that you live in. But I discovered Matt's YouTube channel, Matt McKeever, most Ontario investors do, discovered the Burr investing strategy. So from there, I was able to get a little condo, actually. It was my first off-market deal. We bought it for like $105,000, put like $3,000 into it. Honestly, it was a lot of sweat equity that was put in, so I was doing all the work, and I didn't know anything about renovations or construction or any of that shit. So it was more like a pilot project for me. It was learning, it was great. And then it ended up refinancing at like $160,000, so it ended up actually doing pretty well. But my next couple of properties after that were also like small burrs, just really small cosmetic ones in and around the Sarnia area. And then I actually pivoted to the money partner, passive partner side for my last few deals. I like not getting calls from tenants and dealing with all that other shit. So that's kind of where I'm headed now, more of the passive partner end.
Yeah, no, that totally makes a lot of sense. So I'm actually very interested in that primary residence that you bought and you Airbnb'd. So did you buy it with the intention of Airbnb being the bedrooms? And the reason I ask is because what you find is that, so that's a form of house hacking, right? But what you find is that when you Airbnb by the bedrooms, you get much, much less privacy. And that's what I'm kind of worried about. Cause for me, I'm interested in buying a condo in Toronto. Well, I actually did buy one, thinking about Airbnb being the den, right? Or I live in the den and Airbnb the bedroom. But it's just, when you start house hacking like that, you have people kind of walking around. Like, how did you deal with that? Was that something that you were worried about? Walk me through kind of your thoughts of that.
So I didn't buy it with the intention of Airbnb-ing it out. Actually, it was kind of just something. I was just sitting there one day and I was like, man, I have all this space. Like, why am I not Airbnb in Sarnia would be like popping? I didn't think it'd be a thing. I had the original goal of getting like 10 bookings in a year, and I ended up getting like 10 bookings within the first month, and it ended up doing really well. But to answer your question, like, it's a give and take, right? Like, you just got to weigh the factors. Is your privacy, what's the value of your privacy, right? Like, can you put a dollar figure on it? Our bathroom was on like the main floor with the bedrooms, and the Airbnb room was downstairs. So it was a lot of like cross traffic. Like, you'd see them around, they're in your kitchen kind of thing. So it really depends on your lifestyle. You know, when I was, when my girlfriend wasn't living with me and it was just me in the house and I was working crazy hours, it didn't really bother me. You know, I could, I hardly saw the people a lot of the times. I had self check-in, so it was really hands off. But yeah, like, it really depends on your comfort strategy, or like your comfort levels with having strangers in your home, you know. That was the number one question I always got. Like, don't you feel like unsafe with strangers in your home? But like, I don't know, not really. Like, they're vetted through Airbnb. If somebody's going to come and do something bad, they're not probably not going to put their identification down and like go through a booking platform, right? So not something I was ever concerned about. But we also Airbnb, we still do this when we travel. We'll go on like 3-week trips a couple times a year, or try to at least. So when we're off doing that, or even if it's just a 10-day thing, we'll throw the property up on Airbnb, the full house. And we've had a lot of success with that, actually. When we went to Thailand in 2019, with the Airbnb, with Airbnb being out the whole house, we were gone. It almost paid for majority of our trip, to be honest. So it was really, it was a really nice surprise. Wow.
I love that strategy. That's crazy. Super smart.
Great, man. Like, somebody's watching your house for you. Essentially, you don't get to get a house sitter, none of that shit. You just you make some money while you're off in vacation. That'd be a good strategy for you, Austin.
I guess Airbnb being out your house lets you save up more capital, and then you kept reinvesting that. So you said, you know, you're doing the London, Chatham, Sarnia markets. You know, like, why not just keep it central to one market? Like, stick to London, stick to Chatham, stick to Sarnia. And like, what are really the differences between the three?
Yeah, so I know that everybody says like investing in your backyard is the way to go. And for most people, it probably is. Sarnia is a great market because it has the big boom in petrochemical industry and the refining industry there, which supplies, you know, most of the jet fuel to Pearson Airport, most of the gasoline around Southwestern Ontario. So it's definitely a really big cornerstone to the Ontario economy. And it's really what booms Sarnia. The issue with that is like, the reason I'm investing in real estate, one of the reasons is for job security. So let's say happens in the rare event that the petrochemical industry tanks, or like the refining industry here tanks. So what happens if that scenario comes to life is, you know, the real estate market's going to go down with it. So I didn't want to have all my eggs in one basket in the Sarnia real estate market. So that's kind of why I ventured out to London and Chatham. They're still only an hour away from Sarnia. So if I need to be there quickly, I can be. London's great for appreciation. I already had my first property there, so it was a no-brainer to kind of keep investing there. And then Chatham, I recently just started investing in Chatham. You can still get really low purchase prices, I think, similar to Windsor. So the cash flow there can be really lucrative.
Okay. I mean, I think that's pretty solid. You know, me and Austin, I think a lot of our eggs are in the Windsor market. So, you know, not the best case of diversification there, but I definitely get what you're saying. Like Sarnia, if we're to talk about Sarnia a little bit then, so you said the petroleum industry is driving a good chunk of like the city and the employers, and everything's kind of centralized around that.
Yeah, big part of the employment is the petrochemical industry for sure. And it's also like, as they're expanding, they're bringing in a bunch of temporary workers from out of province. So that has in turn helped inflate the short-term rental market, which is mostly what I do here in Sarnia. So it's been good.
Yeah, so they're expanding, and that, I guess that's like projects that are going to stretch over what, like 5-10 years, or like 1-2 years?
It's supposed to be 1-2. I think it's probably looking like closer to 5, but yeah, it was like a $2 billion expansion at the Nova polyethylene plant there.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's brought a lot of traffic into Sarnia.
Yeah. So you're managing your own properties out there, or do you have property managers for all these different areas?
No, I manage my own in Sarnia. Everything's like a 5-minute drive. It's easier if I just manage it myself. It's pretty hands off. Like, I have cleaners that do all the cleaning, and I have a handyman that I just call on demand if something needs attention. So it's pretty hands off for me here. So yeah, I just save the money and manage it myself.
I love it. So you're just making a couple of phone calls a day if anything happens. You're not going there yourself. Rent, I'm guessing it's through e-transfer or some form of online payment.
Yeah, exactly.
Of all the investors out there, I don't think I know too many Sarnia investors. So I'm really curious, what's the cash flow numbers that you're looking at in Sarnia? It's still definitely a very cash flow heavy market, right?
Yeah, so a single family house is standard 3-bed, 1-bath in an okay neighborhood. You're looking around like $1,500 to $1,700 a month plus utilities. So it is fairly strong. You used to be able to pick those up 2 or 3 years ago all day for like $150,000. Yeah, $150,000. But obviously the rents weren't as high then. But hindsight being 2020, yeah. Nowadays it's you'd be lucky to find something in a decent area for under $250,000. Has been tougher to find them, but as is real estate investing, that's the game, right?
So where do you go from here? So you bought, you were Airbnb or your primary residence. You bought a condo, I believe, at Sarnia as well, right? And where did you go from here? Like, walk me through kind of your process of how you're buying your other properties. Were you saving, money from your full-time job or refinancing? How were you able to fund all of these deals?
Yeah, so it was mostly saving through my full-time job. We had a property actually in Windsor for like, I don't know, probably like 5 months, and that appreciated a little bit from the time we bought it to the time we sold it. So it was a little bit of extra capital there. But yeah, mostly just from saving. Property, Curry, Felix, those are essentially my own capital just going into there. And then Princess is a property I have in London with Adam Martin, and that was a full burr. He did a really good job there. We were able to pull all the capital out, so that just kind of kept rolling. I bought three properties within a month, so it was kind of a hectic time. So the two properties I bought, one was with a partner and one was sole. And then the third property in Sarnia here, I was just going to wholesale it, but the person I approached about it said, you know, why don't you just, like, why don't we JV on it? You know, I'll put up the capital, you do the mortgage, we'll split renovations and like split ongoing management. So that was a nice little win too, rather than just collecting a wholesale fee, actually getting some equity in the deal. And then from there, I just got a duplex in Chatham with Jeremy and Taylor last month, and then we're closing on another one in a couple weeks here, and those will just be quick tenant turnovers once we get them out, lipstick furs, pull capital out and kind of keep it rolling that way.
Nice, nice. So you mentioned that you were going to wholesale a deal. Is that, were you door knocking flyers, or how did you run across these off market deals?
Flyers. I usually put 2,000 flyers out a month in Sarnia, you know, just to keep my nose to the ground there and see if I can find anything. But yeah, we do 2,000 flyers a month to different postal codes through Canada Post.
How do you go about the flyers? Is there like a particular strategy? I know that, I mean, at least in Windsor, because I can speak to that, is a lot of houses are getting four or five different flyers, right? So it's getting kind of repetitive for a lot of homeowners. I'm not sure if it's the same in Sarnia. I know that one of my buddies, Tyler, he's doing it at Woodstock and he's finding a lot of success there. Is Sarnia one of those markets where flyers are working, and how do you make sure to stand out from the rest of their crowd when doing that strategy?
It's been least successful recently. You said it best, like a lot of my rental properties, I'm going to go check the mail once a month and I'll have like four or five different flyers in there. So yeah, I've kind of pivoted from just like spray flyering all of a, like an area. And I'm kind of just, if I'm driving around in the neighborhood, I'll have my phone out and I'll like record the addresses of properties that I think are interesting. And then I'll go to the Sarnia tax office, or I'll get a realtor to pull geo, find the person's name, find out, well, if you pull the geo, you can kind of see like how many properties they own or what properties they own. Because a lot of the times, especially if they're small multi-families, if you just flyer the house itself, you're not going to get in direct contact with the owner. So we actually go to the Sarnia tax office, find out the tax, where they would send the tax mail to, and that's typically their primary address. So I've kind of been pivoting and doing that. The only thing with that is it takes a little bit more time, right? You're driving around neighborhoods, you're going to the tax office and all that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, the success rate definitely better than just spraying.
Yeah, I would imagine. I was just going to say, you probably need boots on the ground people who are looking for those shithole properties, because you're not doing that with every property. You're looking at the ones where the shingles are fucking turned over and there's probably leaky roofs.
Yeah, what I've been doing recently too.
For those of you guys that are home or are listening, our podcast has been lagging a lot for whatever reason. So we've been cutting each other off. So Mayu's just smiling and he's getting a bit upset with the audio, but we'll make it work. Mayu, you're going to edit this, right?
Yeah, so, yeah.
You're good. All right.
Another strategy we've been using recently is like I'll go on Kijiji in the for rent ads and I'll message the landlords on there and say like, hey, do you have any interest in selling your property? I'm a local landlord. And one of the ones I hit up last week was actually the property manager, but it wasn't for a company. It was kind of just an independent property manager. And we just kind of got talking and I told her like, you know, if you are boots on the ground, like if you're walking around any day and you see shitty property that you think would be like a good flip or need some work, if you throw one of my flyers in the mailbox, I'll put like a little star on the bottom left corner. And then I'll know that it was like kind of your flyer, and I'll give you 1% of the purchase price as like a finder's fee. a little bit higher than like your typical $500 or $1,000 fee. But like now I know she's going to be loyal to like my flyers and stuff like that. So there's a ton of creative strategies you can go about to find deals. That's just one of the ones we're using recently.
Yeah, that's genius. Mayu and I have been trying to do something similar in Windsor. So we're calling up people like electricians, plumbers, pest control, basically anyone who touches, sees and smells properties. And it's kind of the same strategy, right? You tell them like, look, we're investors. We're looking to buy any property off market. If you run across anything and you give us the referral, we'll swing you $1,000 if we're able to close on it. So I like that you're leveraging the people out in your network. Is that something that you're looking to get more into, the wholesaling side of things? So, I mean, one of the limitations of being a capital partner is that there's only so much capital you can give unless you're making more capital in the background, which is kind of what you're doing with wholesaling, right?
Small amounts of capital. I'm not wholesaling like at a grand scale or anything like that. But I figure now, like with the appreciation that's happened over the past couple of years and just the odd for every now and then, like I keep that capital rolling. I think the problem I'll run into before running out of capital is running out of lending space. So I'm nearing the 10 mortgages with Scotiabank. But I've been talking to some investors recently. They've been actually reaching out to credit unions and building that relationship with like the credit unions because they're on the private side. And they'll mortgage, like they don't necessarily care how many mortgages they have. If they like you, they trust you, and you're showing like good rent rolls on your properties, then they'll do as many deals as you want at like 75% loan to value. So I think that's probably where I'm going to have to pivot here shortly.
That's awesome, man. What about, did you ever look into like a portfolio mortgage for like bundling up all of your properties into one mortgage and then kind of resetting? That's like something I've heard of and never really met anyone that's actually looked into it, but.
Yeah, no, I've never looked into it. I've heard of it too, but definitely something that should be explored. I have to get my hands on a really good mortgage broker here shortly.
Another thing that I did want to ask Troy is that I remember the first time we've ever chatted. It was through, I think I saw you on Matt McKeever's channel. And then shortly after, we met up at a networking event, and that's where I got to know you. And then you held Project Mayhem for Matt's team. How did that entire relationship come about? Because you're a busy guy. You're doing your own investing. It looks like you're doing some wholesaling. You have your own tenants and you're working, from what I know, a crazy full-time job, way more than a 9-to-5. So was that like a mentorship relationship or what was that exactly?
You know, it was kind of just like me and Jeff had known each other kind of prior to Matt. So I had bought a ticket to the Vegas Mastermind that they had back in 2018. And I had also purchased their first ever wholesaling course. And with like the wholesaling course, you got like a coaching call with Matt McKeever kind of thing. So I just messaged him and I was like, hey, like I'm going to your Vegas Mastermind. Like, would you mind meeting up and like talking shop rather than just having a coaching call, you know, get that face-to-face relationship going. So he agreed to that. I was able to go up to one of their team meetings at the time, which was, I think just like Adam, Jeff and Matt himself. And then, so we built the relationship that way. That's kind of how we had our first introduction. And then, I think he was saying on his story one day that he wanted to, he was looking to hire somebody else or something like that. And I just reached out and I was like, hey, look, like, I don't have the full-time capacity to come work for you guys, but I'd love to help out and like do whatever you need kind of thing. Just to get my foot in the door with them, you know, and like build those relationships and stuff like that. So that's how it's all started. That's how it all started. And then I kind of just started going to like their weekly team meetings and then like doing little random tasks for them. And then, it blossomed into like Project Mayhem, which is where I first met you. And then speaking at some of their Vegas events, OREC and throwing Airbnb masterminds and stuff like that. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. So for our listeners who don't know Matt, Jeff, all of those names that you're hearing, they are, I guess they're a community of real estate investors, pretty big ones in the Canadian real estate scene. And Troy was, I guess he was mentoring under them, giving some free labor in exchange for advice. Yeah. How was that entire experience? Like why did you decide to give up your time? Because I know a lot of people who wouldn't give up the time unless they get paid.
At the time they didn't have like coaching programs or anything like that. So me volunteering or trading away my time for their expertise and advice was really the only way I could figure out to like, you know, get on these guys' radar and like kind of seek the advice from Matt and Jeff and those guys. So, It was kind of an easy decision for me. Like, I know they had this big network and then I wasn't really intertwined in the network. So that was kind of like my end in doing so. And like, that was such a valuable experience because like, it forced me to get out to networking at events. It forced me to get out to other events that they were hosting. It helped me like build up my name kind of, and create a lot of great relationships with some really great people. Like, that's how I met all my JV partners. Like, I met Corey through the network there. I met Adam Martin, obviously, through the network there. Jeremy and Taylor, I met them at one of the masterminds. So, like, getting my foot in the door with those guys and kind of, like, getting to know the network a lot better, it opened a lot of doors for me. So, you know, it's good if you don't have necessarily money or you don't have experience or something like that. Like, you should be volunteering your time, whether it's with some of those guys are like even Austin yourself, or like these people need to be reaching out and like volunteering something that they have in order to get some something back, you know, some knowledge yeah. back.
I mean, ultimately you can, you know, either keep volunteering your time or you're going to pay for mentorship or you're just going to pay for the mistakes that you make. And I think we've all, you know, taken different avenues to that. Austin,
yeah, exactly.
Austin's probably the one that's done all three. Like, you probably had your fair share of mistakes. You've mentored and you've definitely paid for coaching. I went about it opposite. Like, I definitely paid for it early on, and then now I pay for my mentorship. But I think mentorship's key, and you pay for it one way or another. So
yeah, and at the time there was no monetary value, or like there was no monetary option to do the mentorship. So, you know, putting in the hard work was really the only way to do it.
Yeah. So with all these properties, like, I'm curious, you know, Austin kind of touched on it earlier. Definitely have a demanding job. Like, would you describe it as a 9-to-5 and like, or like 9-to-8, and you know, how does that impact your real estate investing?
So I probably work like 55-60 hours a week, I would say. It impacts my real estate investing because like, I just don't have the time now to go and you know, search for off market deals and stuff like that. So that's kind of like why I'm pivoting my portfolio. Cause like, if I'm at work, like, I know my JV partners are, you know, managing the contractors or managing the tenants and doing all that stuff that I necessarily can't do. So, you know, if you don't have the time, you have to be able to put up the capital and all, and yeah, in order to keep acquiring properties. And that's kind of the path I've taken.
So at some point, doesn't it kind of become a trade-off between, you know, at some point your day job is not really going to make sense, right? If you're making kind of better returns on real estate, the cash flow is building up. At some point, the stack gets so big that the opportunity cost of going to work becomes too high, right?
And just an FYI, Mayu and I are still working full time.
Yeah, so, yeah. And so this is...
No judge zone.
And this is a debate that me and Austin have like all the time, right? Where I go to work and I'm missing out on an off market. And like today morning, I messaged someone. And I didn't realize they replied to me until like 3 p.m. And then they already had another offer, right? So like shit like that happens. And it's like, frick, like what's the point of going to work now?
Yeah. For sure you would be, you are trading it off. So, I know, I mean, that's like typically why I'm going with a JV partner route, because they can handle all that, the day-to-day maintenance. But yeah, I do agree. Like, if you miss one off-market deal that you could have wholesaled for 30 grand because you're at your job making $800 or $900 a day, yeah, that definitely sucks. I'm sure there will become a crossroads time where it doesn't make sense anymore, but you know, I do like my job. I work with a lot of really good people. So, you know, for the meantime, I will definitely be holding it. There are some part-time options too, and you can kind of pivot or take leaves, like long leave of absences. That's been done before. But yeah, it definitely makes it a harder decision when you really like your job. So
what's the goal with you for real estate investing? Cause a big thing that stood out is that you said you liked your job. There are, believe it or not, guys, there are people out there who like their job. Yeah. I might not be one of them, but there are people out there, and Troy is a living example of one of them. And I think a lot of the motivation for a real estate investor is financial freedom, escape the 9-to-5. Let's get out of here. Let's go travel. So what's your big why that's driving you to continue to invest? Because you don't have a small portfolio by any means, and you're always looking to acquire.
That's a good question, man. I guess my main reason for doing it is because, you know, you got to do something with the money. You can't just leave it sit in the bank. I would like to have a portfolio that can support me if something does happen to my job, or if one day I do decide to not work anymore. And I just fucking love it, dude. Like, I just love the feeling when, like, you know, you find an off market deal, you're going to close on a property, and you know that like there's you're getting a 30K spread. So, you know, as soon as you sign those papers and you close on that deal, like you automatically made 30K. Like that's the sexy shit, man. That's the stuff that keeps me coming back per se. You know, $200, $300, $400, $500 a month cash flow is nice, but like I just like making the money on the buy, man. It's just, it's addicting. Like, yeah, it's just super addicting. Like
real life addicting feeling. No, I love it. It's true. It's real life,
man. And pretty fucking cool to say you own like fucking 8, 10, whatever properties, like just like crazy conversations that like, and you can't really have those conversations with people not in real estate because it's not like a fully understood thing. But like, yeah, man, it's just, it's fucking addicting.
But yeah, no, I think that makes sense, man. You know, definitely a lot of people have their own reasons. I think you also touched on it earlier, right? Like you don't know where, I think you work in a more volatile maybe industry than other people. Sure. So you never know what the future of that industry is. Even if it's not like 2-3 years, like 20, 30 years from now, and you're like 55 and, like that worries me as well, right? Like, so I'm an accountant and it should be relatively stable, but I meet like accountants all the time that are like 55, 60 years old and then they get laid off at a company they've been at for like 20 years and they're just like, well, what do I do now, right? Like I only know my one company and my one industry. So it is kind of still touching on financial independence, but the difference being you're not in a rush, right? Like you're playing the long game.
Definitely not in a rush, so I have that advantage.
So, I mean, with all that being said, Troy, I think you've dropped a lot of great nuggets for all the listeners on, you know, how to grow your portfolio, how to really even get started in real estate and just continue to scale from there, even if it's like whether it's acting as an active partner, wholesaling deals, or even funding your own deals. So with that being said, we will now move on to the rapid fire round.
Okay, we don't have a name for this round. We're just gonna literally call it something else every episode till we're at episode 20, and then we'll just figure it out after. But yeah, rapid round. So basically, the three questions that we ask every guest. First question, Mayu, I'm gonna let you start it off.
Okay, so I think we kind of touched on this earlier, but where are we going to see Troy 5 years from now?
You know, 5 years from now, I hope I'm doing like anything that I really want to do without any time restrictions or being locked down anything specifically. You know, we love to travel, so I'd love to be traveling around at least 6 months of the year. That would be awesome. And at least have a real estate portfolio where the income is enough that, you know, if I decide that I don't like my job anymore, if that happens, then I can act on it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, traveling 6 months out of the year would be great. I personally wish I could travel 12 months out of the year, but 6 months is good enough too. Question number two is, what would you do if you won $10 million?
$10 million, man, have you guys got a different answer from this yet? Or is everybody just say, invest it?
No. Yeah, if you take away the investing aspect, what would you do? Let me get to know Troy a little bit more better.
All right. 500. You know what? I would honestly probably pay off a lot of close friends' mortgages. You know, I'd probably buy everybody in my immediate family like a house. Houses are pretty cheap in Sarnia, so we can do that. Not like the Toronto area, but I used to run this Give a Kid a Christmas fundraiser thing around Christmas time where we would essentially pool money and toys for kids whose parents, you know, maybe didn't have the money or whatever their misfortune was. So I would probably pour, you know, a good chunk of that into a fundraiser or something like that and make sure it's an ongoing thing year after year, helping families in the local communities. I would have a pretty good weekend in Vegas with some really close friends for sure. We'd have some fun down there and, you know, I would just travel, man. Like,
I love it. This guy's going to travel $10 million in 1 year.
I'm joking. Yeah. I love it. I gotta go Vegas last. So I don't blow it all there. I gotta do all the other shit first.
That's awesome, man. So I mean, one last question then. If you were to have dinner with one person, either dead or alive, like it could be anyone, who would you choose and why?
I could probably give you the classic cliche answer of like Gary Vee or Grant Cardone or one of those guys. But honestly, it would probably either be like my late father, you know, catch up and have a beer, or the owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers. So I can kind of swindle my way into some sweet job there. I'm a big sports fan. So I think that would be a pretty interesting, interesting dinner.
That's awesome. Networking.
Yeah, networking
for that dream job.
Not gonna lie, my answer, which is like one of the earlier ones, was Gary Vee, and I've heard some pretty cool answers now after that. So yeah. 10 regret. So, yeah, that's awesome. All right. So
Gary V's a safe one, man. Gary V's a safe one.
Okay. Thank you, Troy. Thanks for answering the rapid fire round there. So if anyone wants to follow you or get in touch with you, talk about any of your projects, anything you've got going on, how can they find you?
Yeah, just hit me up on Instagram. It's Troy PIR.
You'll find it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll definitely put that in the show notes. So that being said, we've had a great conversation full of a lot of great legs. Hopefully we were able to put this together for everyone to enjoy. So with that being said, until next time, live better, invest better.